Thanks, Barry. So I've been really impressed by some of the long-term work that's been done, and a lot of it which has been highlighted in the last few talks. And you know, I think that really displays some real commitment and dedication from researchers, and I'm just incredibly impressed by it. I'm going to talk about the exact opposite of that. In exchange for depth, I'm going to be substituting breadth. And so I'm going to be talking about on-farm experimentation. And I guess I'm going to advocate for why I believe that it's a great supplement to long-term trials. And I think it's really crucial in terms of creating the most localized management that is really adaptable and resilient to climate change. So I'll start off by talking a little bit about variability and sort of setting the stage for this. Semi-arid farmers have to deal with so many different forms of variability. They have to deal with economic variability in terms of fluctuating prices, both for inputs and for the crop. They have to deal with biological variability in terms of weeds and pests. Climatic variability, obviously, is the big one in dry land systems, with precipitation being the biggest driver. And that is very sporadic and very difficult to predict as well. And then edaphic uncertainty, so variation in soils. And all of these things come together to impact the trajectories of individual farms and of farming systems as a whole. Now, I'm just going to lead off with a few examples of this. So this is a field site near Great Falls, Montana, and it's about 50 miles from as the crow flies from the nearest agricultural research center. And what we see here is that between the research center and the field site, the conditions are actually fairly similar in a lot of ways. So the textures are quite similar. The depth of soil is actually quite similar, although way more variable at the field site. The pHs are similar. I should note I didn't display here, but the nitrogen content of the soil is quite similar. But what I want to highlight here is that the yields are more than double most of the time at this research center. And there could be any number of explanations for this. It could be simply due to agronomic management, perhaps issues of timing. It could be due to weed pressure. It could be due to sawfly. It could be due, perhaps those slight differences in precipitation really make all the difference. But my point in bringing up this example is not to provide an overwhelming explanation or sort of justification for conditions being different at these sites, but it's more to highlight that I think that this is more the rule rather than the exception, that what we see at field sites is quite a bit different than what we see at experimental centers. And so whether or not the results from experiment stations are applicable to field sites is a really important question. If I broaden my scope a little bit, I'll just display some results from a real rough and ready regression with taking county-level USDA data, survey data for the last 50 years. And what I did was I regressed that against precipitation, growing season precipitation. I controlled for a few other factors, especially considering the increase of technology over the years. And then what I did was I simulated different price and precipitation scenarios. So I looked at what happens when precipitation is low or high, what happens when the prices fluctuate as well, when they're plus or minus two standard deviations. And then all of that feeds into a model for net return. So just a real simplified model here, where net return is the function of the price of the crop times the quantity produced minus the cost, minus the fertilizer and fixed costs. Excuse me, that should be a multiplication sign between the crop, the quantity of fertilizer and the price. And what we see here is just a spatial representation of these relationships. So the columns here are unfavorable to favorable price scenarios, and the rows are unfavorable in the top, so minus two standard deviations, to plus two standard deviations precipitation scenarios. And if we look in the upper left, what we see is that overwhelmingly, in a wheat fallow rotation, farmers were really not earning a lot of money. But as we get out of that really unfavorable scenario, what we see is that really the spatial patterning of the net returns becomes apparent. So there's a huge amount of spatial variability county to county, with, of course, the wetter counties tending to have higher net returns. So this is a map of average annual precipitation in Montana. And when I showed you that map of county-level net returns, I brought that up because research stations are somewhat placed in order to be able to deal with this. right? So they are spatially distributed throughout the state of Montana. And I should state, I am talking about Montana here, but I think a lot of the principles that I'm discussing are fairly applicable in other locations as well. So these research stations are somewhat distributed throughout the state to be representative of local conditions, so both climate and soils. And so if you're in the neighborhood of one of these research centers, then that's where you might get your recommendations from. You're obviously going to be consulting many other sources, but that is might be one of the many of them. Excuse me. But as we saw in the beginning, the differences at the field site or the field site can be quite different than the experimental stations. Furthermore, within those sites, we can have a whole lot of variability as well. So this is subfield variation. So what we're looking at here is variability in yields, variability in the topographic water index, so that just represents the amount of water accumulation in a field, variation in protein, variation in weed density, variation in electrical conductivity, and variation in nitrate. So we have these hierarchies of correlation or of variation where we have differences between the research centers and the field sites, and then within the field sites we have a lot of subfield variation. So farmers have to contend with all these different sources of variability and try to make some sort of rational decisions. That's very challenging. If we take just a simplistic example, let's say a farmer has three different soil textures at their farm. They are considering applying three different levels of nitrogen. They might experience three different potential levels of precipitation, and they might foresee perhaps three different levels of prices. So how many combinations do all these factors make? That makes 81 different combinations. So how in the world are they supposed to be able to manage all this? It's a really challenging thing. And now you know that what they are doing is they have some sort of mental model of how they are actually sort of factoring in all these components. Some are weighted more heavily than others. But they have to consider all these things. So typically at research stations, what we do is we have the paradigm of controlling many factors and just looking at how one or two things vary, right? So what might be the optimal level of nitrogen applied? What might be, you know, the best crop rotation? And we isolate everything else and then look at just those individual factors, maybe a few at a time. But generally, that's the principle. However, of course, if we just look at pests, This is a graph of systemic stress on the x-axis versus farmer well-being on the y-axis. And if we just look at one factor, say pests, that might decrease farmer well-being a little bit. And at the experimental station, we might say, okay, well, we have a treatment for that. We can deal with that. But then, of course, you have increased input prices, and that might decrease farmer well-being a little bit more. But then you add drought on top of that, as we might experience under climate change, and that might push farmers over a threshold of well-being from which it is very difficult to recover. So really, it's important to integrate all of these uncertainties to try to understand agricultural systems at the farm scale. So that is the current model of farm research. So the current model of farm research and extension is, again, based upon developing principles at research centers or universities, wherever it might be, and applying those principles on farms. What I'm advocating for is that we instead should have somewhat of the opposite. And now, I'm not trying to say that there is no value in experimentation, especially long-term experimentation at experimental stations, because farmers are never going to be able to do that and to have the rigor and quality that we would see at those stations. However, we cannot accurately represent the variability that is experienced by the farmers. So really, I think that in the terms of empowering farmers, we can turn them into knowledge generators. So they generate the knowledge, and then university and extension personnel help facilitate that knowledge generation and test the first principles that they might be discovering on their farms. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about how this might take place. So I'll talk first about on-farm small plot trials. So let's say we want to achieve optimal site-specific management. How might we do that? What if a farm changed three practices every year? What if they tried one new crop? What if they tried one different quantity of nutrient application? What if they tried one different type of herbicide? And what if they considered the interactions of these three variables? How much experimentation would we actually need to get the optimal management of these factors? So again, this is just a real simple example. Crops, nutrients, and herbicide, the C, N, and H. And then we're looking at the bivariate interactions and then the trivariate interaction. And then, of course, we have a control. And perhaps this farm has three different soil types. So that means 24 combinations. And say, just as an arbitrary number, we need 6 replications for each treatment. That equals 144 blocks on one farm. Is a farmer ever really going to do that? It looks like this, if this one field represents a whole farm. Probably not. They probably are not going to be able to implement this level of experimentation. However, if we have two farms, right, that are somewhat similar, then we can actually spread out the burden and cost of experimentation across those farms. If we have three farms, then the burden becomes even less. Now, of course, as we increase those numbers of farms, those blocks per farm, the number of blocks required per farm decreases. But there is a caveat to that, in that as we increase those numbers of farms, there's going to be more potential for introducing heterogeneity. So there's going to be some sort of asymptote to the number of farms you can appropriately accumulate while reducing the number of blocks per farm. And so I guess what I envision is having regional networks of on-farm experimentation. And this is just a real basic depiction of that. And in reality, these networks would be much smaller because I think that the regional variability would dictate that. But say you might have 100 farmers who are collaborating on this on-farm experimentation to get the most locally adapted management that also is adapted to the climate. And so far, I've been talking about small-scale, small-plot trials. And the reality of it is that in the western U.S., most agriculture is much larger scale. So I think there's some opportunities for actually automating this. So instead of having the burden of experimentation be totally manual and physical, we can have it be computational. And when we're doing this, we can bring in historical data on crop yields or crop or ecological data. We can integrate that with historical economic data and historical weather data. And all of those things are modified by past management actions. And then we can bring those into spatiotemporal driver response models and to generate systemic understanding and optimization. And so over time, we can start to increase our understanding of the system and achieve the best management at a site-specific scale. So just in the most basic example, the way this might occur with, say, nitrogen management is that we have an initial yield in a particular field, and we're interested in what the response of the crop is to nitrogen in different locations in this field. So we might stratify this field into low, medium, and high yield. We would apply nitrogen rate experiments in those different strata, and by the way, I've automated this procedure, so it doesn't have to require any input from the farmer. Plus, they can get a map back out that automatically applies the nitrogen rates. So really, this smooths out that burden of experimentation that I discussed before, as we see with small plot trials. Then we can observe the yields in the next year. And then we can calculate profits and slowly, year after year, do the same thing over and over and over again and increase our understanding of how different spatial locations in the field respond differently to nitrogen. And what we achieve after 6 years, it appears, at least theoretically in dryland systems, is that we get an optimal prescription of fertilizer throughout the field. Now, that's just one factor, so we would need to do a lot more experimentation to consider other factors as well. Okay, so I've talked so far about small plot trials. I've also discussed how we might be able to integrate automation in order to facilitate those trials on a larger scale. And now I'll talk a little bit about whether or not or how we might be able to actually get this on-farm experimentation off the ground on a large scale. So, social factors and challenges. Okay, what we're looking at here is a graph from 1965, to 2012 of the coefficient of variation of different factors. So what this represents is the amount of variability or uncertainty in these things that I plotted. So what I plotted is the price of wheat in gold here. I think that looks gold. Yeah, gold. The price of nitrogen in red. And then the Palmer Z index for the northern area of Montana in blue. So that's basically a short-term measure of drought. And when I calculate the coefficient of variation on that, that's done on a 5-year rolling basis. Finally, with that green line, I add all of those things together to look at the total variability in the system. So what we notice here immediately is that there's a large peak in the mid to late 70s, in the mid to late 80s, and then a substantial prolonged period of uncertainty for the farmer in the early to, well, mid 2000s. And what I did was I interviewed farmers trying to understand their responses to this uncertainty and to this variability. I did a series of interviews and surveys, excuse me. And what I found was that during the periods when there is a more calm climate and prices, then farmers would tend to implement much more experimentation. So they were less cautious about it. However, when variability was very high, they would almost unanimously revert to wheat fallow rotations. So that was their conservative practice that they fell back on and they believed would get them out of the tough periods. So in between those periods, they would ramp up their experimentation as we've seen with pulses. And then during the times that were tough, they would go back to wheat fallow. So now in the northeastern Montana, we're up to 12.4%. Perhaps it's probably a little bit higher now that is in pulses. But then presumably during a period when there was drought, then that would taper off. So uncertainty really structures how much farmers are willing to adopt on-farm experimentation. And when they are considering implementing on-farm experimentation, of course, they follow a fairly understandable set of constraints. So first, they're thinking about economic viability. Now second, they're thinking about rotation, which I found very surprising. They all internalize the value of rotation across the board. So I think if we could harness that and really promote on-farm experimentation, then we could entrench that as a mode of operation for farmers in northern Montana. And then, of course, they're thinking about logistics. A few other challenges is it takes intensive prodding of farmers in order to be able to piece all of this together and actually get them to carry out the on-farm experimentation with the appropriate rigor. And speaking of rigor, ensuring spatial accuracy, that timing is similar across locations is really challenging. There's so many other factors, and it really does take facilitators in order to be able to get this to actually work. The other thing is it requires complicated statistical structures when we're using precision ag data. I've had to deal with this a lot, and we might have to use mixed effects models. We might have to consider hierarchical models or spatial autoregressive models, especially when we have lattice data across a field. And then we might be interested more in looking at probabilities rather than thinking about p-values. So Bayesian statistics might come in. And then we also always have to be guarded against multiple comparisons when we're looking at trials in different locations. We can't just be hunting for what we think might, or for different things that might have an impact. Because when we add all those together, we're going to see a significant difference, but whether or not that's real is another question. All right, finally, I just want to touch on managing complexity. So I've talked about some really simplistic examples of on-farm experimentation, and I think that really, ideally, we would have much more complexity in our systems. But of course, that becomes increasingly challenging to manage from a statistical point of view. So once we add in more complexity, say for a market garden, which has 10 different crops in rotation, they have very, very heterogeneous spatial patterns, then we have to consider zooming out in our perspective and looking at, okay, well, what's the difference between this farm that has 5 crops in rotation versus this farm that has 10 crops in rotation, right? So we have to aggregate at a certain level and zoom out. So at the simplified level, when we're looking at individual factors, We will be focusing on individual processes, and when we zoom out to complex systems, we'll be focusing on emergent properties. Now, I want to mention, I think that really in the state of Montana, we're pretty much, in some ways, we're on the tail end of this on-farm experimentation, because I know in many other states, especially Midwestern states, this is fairly well implemented, and there are teams of people who are going out and assisting farmers with it. But I think even there, we can do a lot more, and every single farmer who I have talked to does experimentation, whether or not they'll admit it or not. They will experiment with 20 acres of crops, trying one new thing. They'll experiment with 200 acres. It doesn't really matter what the scale is, but they're trying new things, and they're usually not doing it with replication or with controls, so it's sort of an ad hoc procedure. But the point is that they're doing it, and so I think we can capitalize on that to really develop on-farm experimentation. So this Montana Research and Economic Development Initiative that I have noted up here is one that has been initiated recently to implement some of these nitrogen rate experiments that I talked about on 6 different farms in this first year, looking at a couple different crops and measuring yield and protein as the output variables. And this is led by my graduate advisor, Bruce Maxwell. And so I think this is just one example of how this might be led by the universities, but really also led by farmers, where they are sort of choosing what some of these experiments might be. All right, thank you. Yeah, that's really important, especially when we consider soils, right? So soils is the big nasty one in the room that it's really difficult to get the appropriate covariates for. And, you know, there's some proxies for soil, like electrical conductivity. I know there's some other presentations going on right now that are talking about some other ways of sensing variation in soils. But you do need to account for that, right? And ideally, we would have also the most site-specific, like a weather station on each individual farm. But, of course, that's not reality, so we have to interpolate between weather stations. So there's all sorts of different covariates that need to be taken into account, and you have to get a little bit creative when you're starting out. But I think that this will improve over time as the profusion of sensors gets even greater. Yeah.
I mean, I guess we tend to use very simple designs.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because we can't run properly. So we measure as many covariates as we possibly can.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I appreciate that comment because, you know, I'm talking about, I think in general, so far the focus in this session has been on large-scale systems, and I really believe that there's just as much advantage to be gained from on-farm experimentation from small-scale systems, and it doesn't need to be technologically complex. I think, but it's especially the benefit of having farmers involved in the process and sort of really engaging in it, I think that's really not to be underestimated. Other questions? Yeah.
Just a comment that really resonates with me.
Okay.
Because on that note, when I came to college at the University of this class talking about some data, and the student said to me, well, gosh, does that apply where I live? That's where I live. It wasn't anywhere near accurate.
Yeah, I meant to actually mention that in more detail.
Fertility is always good.
Yeah.
So going out and working on farmer fields brings in variability. One of the problems we had getting science
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge. I mean, but that's the reality is the thing. So yeah, it's for sure. No, I agree. Yeah. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, and I think related to the management too, I think a lot of times we think when we're moving it from the station to the farm, we need to control as many things as possible. There's a role for that, but I think the other thing is being able to measure that variability. And so not just the, you know, the other covariates that we talked about in terms of the physical, but also the management covariates.
Yeah, management is a huge one for sure. Are there any other questions? I meant to, I didn't really say anything about my thank you slide, but I definitely want to thank Perry for inviting me to talk here today, and I really appreciate that, and he's been really helpful throughout the last few years for me, so thanks.
I see you've got another name on the slide there towards the bottom. I
actually would, and this is a farmer, Mr. Chuck Merja is a farmer who actually has an engineering degree from Stanford, so he's a little bit unusual. But he's been instrumental in actually collaborating with Montana State University over many years. And he is constantly tinkering with his fields and gathering data, which sometimes can be a little bit frustrating, but it's also a huge opportunity. And he's really been incredible in terms of pushing this forward just for the last, you know, for the last 15, 20 years. I don't know how long, but he's been incredible. So definitely need to thank him. Any other questions? Great, thank you.